in Germany, they're 1949, 48 or whatever. Because Dad didn't really have a job, right? Remember, he used to go door to door selling spices.
And this was where? Around Romerts.
Romerts, yeah. So anyway, certain weeks, whenever the exhibitions were on, he had a booth. And we'd go to these exhibitions or where there was a racetrack, or like the motorcycle races and that. And everybody always had the roulette wheel, you know, and the win and this and that. He wanted to do something different. So he went to some wholesaler, and you get all kinds of things like these little stuffed monkeys on a rubber string on a bungee cord, or the little pitchers that came out when you moved the pitchers. The pitcher would move. We called them wiggle-built pitchers. And the little flowers that you pin in your lapel and you tell somebody to smell it, and then you squeeze the rubber ball with water in it in your pocket. And the booth, the name he gave it was 1001 Odd and Interesting Things. And rather than a game of roulette and chance to win anything, it was just a straight buy. And everything was just, you know, 5 cents, 10 cents, 25 cents. Everybody always had a nickel or $2, a penny, you know, in their pocket. And one of the things that was interesting, where I got involved heavy with, was some new thing they come out with, and you put it in the roof of your mouth, you make it wet, stick it to the roof of your mouth and your palate, and then you try to talk with it by squeezing your tongue up a little bit, but you try to talk, and it altered your voice.
It made you sound squeaky, like Mickey Mouse or something.
Like Mickey Mouse, exactly, or like, you know, Donald Duck, or like the chipmunks. So anyway, he bought this, and when he goes to the wholesalers, of course, he has to buy a case of it. You know, it's 12 times a dozen, right? And all those little things, they were cheap. And it was a little tiny piece of metal about the size of your thumbnail with a little piece of cellophane in it, and it looked like a horseshoe. And you just sort of wet it, stick it to the top of your mouth, on the palate. Well, he tried it, and he couldn't do it. And these things were laying there, and nobody would buy it. And then he said, "Paul, you try." Well, I was only six. So I tried it, and I got the hang of it really quick, and I could have whistled with it and everything, and it sounded like a canary. You know, sound like Donald Duck and things. And if you laughed, it'd really come up warbled. So I got good at it almost immediately. And he sent me out as public relations in amongst the crowds. And I was doing this. And everybody, "What are you doing? How do you do that?" "Oh, I got this nice little thing. Where'd you get it?" "I got it over there. 1001 things. It's only 15 cents. 15 pennies, right?" Well, it was only a day and a half later, that whole case of things was gone. So that was my fort. Every time we went, in the summertime, we'd go 3 or 4 times to these carnivals.
All over? Like just in Romerts
area?
No,
it was in the next town, Sometimes it was like a 4-hour, 3-hour drive away, you know. And we always, this booth, you know, 10 foot by 10 foot, and the 2x4s were made with bolts, bang, take them apart, folded together, and the bed sheets, Mom had sewed bed sheets for the canvas and the roof and that. Sign up front, and away we went, right? After the first year, of course, everything went smooth as silk then. And we always had somebody else, a big trucker, that had to go anyway and take other people. Well, this one time we went to this, I think it was Karlsruhe, motorcycle races, 3-hour drive away. And, you know, and you go there Thursday night to set up.
And how did you get there? Did you have a car at the time?
No, this was somebody with a big 5-ton truck. Stakeside truck, and he was taking other people down too, and maybe taking food down or something, I don't know. So we set up Thursday night, and it starts to pour rain. We're in a local hotel or something, right? Pour rain all day Friday. You know, cloudburst, downpour all day long. They canceled the races, no people. Saturday, rain all day long. And then Sunday morning at dinner time or something, the clouds finally lifted, the sun came out, and they held some of the exhibitions or some of the races or some of the carnival, whatever they were going to do. Well, then it was try to make your money, try to pay for everything. You had to pay, you know, $50 a day for stand fee, and you had to pay the trucker to get there. And it was 3 days of being away from home, right? So Now, how do you make it all pay in one afternoon? And that was the day we were the busiest, of course, you know. And I was out just drumming up the business with this little thing, and I had this little flower on the lip, on my jacket or shirt or something. And I'd tell all these little guys, you know, hey, smell this flower. Squirt them in the face, you know, and laugh about it, you know. Where'd you get that? I said, right over there. They got me, you know. And then I'd have these wiggle bill pictures, you know, Mickey Mouse on it and Donald Duck or whatever they had in Germany in those days, right? And as you wiggle the bill pitcher, the pitcher would wiggle. And that was a new thing. And by goodness, by the time 6-7 o'clock Sunday night come, we dead, and just about the best day ever, and almost sold out of everything. You know, there was only a few things left of each item. And we all almost literally had 1,000 things, maybe 600 items, but it was, the store was called 1001 Odd and Interesting Things. So that was... But these monkeys on the bungee cord. Another thing was a sort of a little parrot. Now you put him at the top of a little ladder, and he just works his way all the way down the ladder as he falls. And that was another thing that sold real good.
So at that time, Max wasn't a butcher or didn't know anything about the meat
trade?
Oh,
yes.
So why was he selling all this stuff if he had his trade as a butcher?
Side business.
We were refugees. And you just, you know, you just couldn't walk into a place to get a job because, you know, there was 3 million or 5 million Germans all crowded into the area. Hmm. You know, we were refugees from the east, squeezed in there, and they didn't like us. They didn't want to give us jobs. And because we were refugees, the local people didn't like that because the government assisted us in housing costs. And then if we get a job, the local people thought we were taking their job, so there was animosity. The other thing was in Fulda, that's the central part of the Catholicism, that's the headquarters of German Catholic, the archdiocese there, and the Romans and Alzal Catholic, and we were Protestants, we were Lutherans. And so there's a hatred, just like Northern Ireland, you know, the orange and the green, the same kind of thing. They didn't like you, and you were from the east. Why now didn't you go back home? Well, come here, you take my job, cost me my taxes, you know, the government's subsidizing you guys. And so there was that animosity, so you just didn't get a job easy, so Dad made himself self-employed. And that's we called them Flüchtlinge, or refugees. Runaways. All the Flüchtlinge made themselves self-employed. A lot of them went door to door selling nylons and nylon combs and aluminum pots and pans, all the things that were coming back out of after the war. And it got so that the people were so annoyed by this because four times a day you had somebody knock on the door selling the same thing. And the next day the same thing again. And the next day the same thing again, three or four guys knocking your door. And so it was a hatred, you know. No salesman, keep away, get off my property. So Dad said, I got to do something different. So Dad started selling spices. Gewürz und Darmhandel, which was spices and sausage casings handling. And because of his meat background, he knew all about the spices and sausage casings. And he knew that every farmer in the country, almost every house almost, had a pig or two, and it would get killed in the fall of the year, and then they'd get made into sausages, and they need spices. During the war, there were no spices. It was all embargoed from Africa and from Zambia and from Grenada, ginger and allspice and mace and pepper. None of the countries would sell to Germany, so there was very little, or imitation pepper, you know, and things like that, or the cheapest stuff that no other country would buy. Well, Germany would have to buy it. So after the war in 1946, when the borders were open and some of these spices were coming back in and the wholesalers started to carry it, Dad grabbed that opportunity. He'd go to a wholesaler and he'd buy 10 pounds of pepper and 10 pounds of mace and 10 pounds of ginger and 10 pounds of allspice and coriander. And then we had a little postage scale. And he bought, you know, thousands of little tiny bags. And with the postage scale, it was my mother and my job to weigh the spices with a little scoop, 2 ounces in a bag, and I'd lick it. 2 ounces, and I'd lick it. Of course, it was my job just before that to stamp all these bags. Pepper, make 50 pepper bags, 50 ginger bags, 50 this bags, 50 that, or 100 maybe. And then you fill all the pepper into the pepper bags and all the ginger into the ginger. That was our job. While in the daytime, Dad went out door to door with a suitcase. And then things like pepper or ginger or something would make maybe 200 grams. And when Dad buy 20 kilograms of pepper, he'd pay maybe, you know, a dollar a pound for it. But then if you divide it up into so many ounces or so many grams, you don't not only double your money, or you 10 times your money. Hmm. You know, so 100 grams almost the same price as a kilo. But you sell 10 bags, so you're making, you know, 900% profit. It doesn't look much in the little bag, you know, $1.50 for a little paper bag of 20 ounces or 100 ounces in it, 100 grams in it, but that was like 900 times your profit. And same thing, mace or ginger, allspice, and a few other things. All the things you need to make sausages. Cinnamon was another thing. And then 1948, the real Dutch cocoa came back on the market. And so Dad would buy maybe 20 kilos of cocoa or 50 kilos of cocoa, the real, we're making chocolate milk. And then we'd make it, you know, half a kilo packages. And again, you know, it was 500% markup. And he would go then door to door with a suitcase. First, it was just around our village and town. The next, the two or three villages, Neuhof and Vlieden and Schlichten. But then after a few weeks, he went out another 10 kilometers further away, made it a bigger circle, and then a bigger circle. So that, and then once a month, he'd go back, like every 4 or 5 week circuit. First he walked, the first few months he walked the local villages. Then he borrowed my uncle's bicycle. And then one day, going up over one of the little hills, mountains, the bicycle frame broke. So he had to leave the bicycle, and he went to a local shop. And he got a real cheap motorcycle, a Sachs 90.
Any idea what it cost him?
500 mark or something like that. It wasn't much, like, well, 10 weeks' work, right? Anyway, so one night he comes home at 6 o'clock with this little motorcycle, and we all look, who's this? It's Dad, he's got a motorcycle. Yeah, the bicycle's in Neufarn or something, 30 miles away, broken. So then for a year and a half, he had the motorcycle. And of course, his tour got, now he was able to go longer distances and come home faster, carry more suitcases. And until it got to the point where the motorcycle was overloaded and the thing would overheat, and the spark plug would all soot up, and he'd have to take the spark plug out and clean it, he'd say. And it got to the point where he wanted to buy himself a Volkswagen. He was negotiating the price of a used Volkswagen with one of the guys, other people, and just about bought it, but that's when things changed when we made preparation to come to Canada.
Do you know why he went to Canada and nowhere else? I mean, there must have been other countries that were also taking refugees at the time, or... I don't know. Why didn't our family end up in Australia?
Well, that's right. Most went to Australia or South America, Chile and Venezuela and Ecuador, Peru, Australia... We didn't have the money. We couldn't. We didn't have the money. And then in early 1950, Canada opened the door to German immigrants. And he said, that's not too far, just across the ocean. That's where we're going. So that's the reason why then we applied to Canada. So it was the end of 1951 that we left. It was January 52 we arrived.
And what do you remember about it?
I remember the last 3 or 4 months selling everything and making arrangements with people that wanted the furniture, and somebody that took over our exhibition booth, and somebody that took over Dad's suitcase business, and then making the arrangements. We were supposed to go about 6 months earlier, but there was a problem with Dad's x-ray. He had pneumonia once when he was a child, 17, and they pulled the water out of his pleurisy, they pulled water out of his lungs, they left the scars, and on the x-ray that showed, and they questioned it, and it held us up for 6 or 9 months. But then it was okay. They thought it might have been tuberculosis. On the boat ride from Bremerhaven, I remember that I was seasick for 7 days, me and my mother. I remember that. Inga and Dad were, at the end of it, Inga and Dad and maybe four other people were the only ones in the cafeteria on the boat. Out of 300 passengers, there was about five, Dad said five or six.
Did you have your own cabin, or did you have to share with a lot of other people?
No, we had a cabin. We had two or three bunks in it. Yeah. I was in one bunk, Inga the other, and Dad and Mom at the bottom.
And then you landed, and you were supposed to go out west, but didn't.
Yeah, everything was destined for Winnipeg, tickets and everything, and the two or three large trunks, the trunks are about the size of the kitchen table. I still have one at home there yet. Anyway, it was all marked Winnipeg via Halifax. And in Halifax, of course, it was unloaded and put right on the trains. And after doing our customs and passports and getting these immigrant clearance, we were told to get on the train. And so on the train then, and then the conductor come along just before the train left, looking for tickets. So Dad pulls the ticket out. And there was a problem. The ticket was actually just good for one adult. And he asked for the other tickets. And Dad said, there are no other tickets. So then there was a problem there with the tickets on the train. And there were no other tickets. We only had one adult ticket. So, well, with translators, and Dad couldn't understand what all the problem was. Then they got translators. And it was suggested the wife and the children stay in Halifax in the dormitories, immigration. And Dad would go on to Winnipeg. So Dad made sure we got into the dormitory okay and everything was decent there. And it was a really good dormitory up above Pier 21.
Did you actually come into Pier 21?
That's where we came in. Downstairs, all the big baggage rooms and all the people were screened there. And then upstairs was the dormitories and kitchen and cafeteria and waiting rooms. And the dormitories were very good. Everything was excellent there. And so women and young children were in one big dormitory room, 20, 30 sets of bunk beds. You know, I remember three rows of bunk beds, three high. Mom was at the bottom, and Inga was in the second, and I was in the third. And so Dad checked us out, made sure everything was okay, and he got back on the train. And he sits in the train for 2 minutes, and he says, oh my God, my papers. When we went through immigration and customs, and everything was stamped, Mom just gathered all the papers up, put them in her purse, instead of Dad having his papers in his vest pocket. Oh, and my passport, everything's in Mom's purse. So he has to run out, down through the corridors, off the train, down through the corridors, up the stairs, down the corridor. And now at this point, it's almost 10 o'clock at night. And so he knocks on the dormitory door. And the matron opened up the door, and Dad immediately said, well, Mom immediately reacted, gave him the passport, I remember that very quick, and other important papers, like trade papers. And again, with a goodbye kiss, and quick, down the corridor he runs, and he tries to get out. And the commissioner locked the door, because it was 10 o'clock, and wouldn't let him out. Now, Dad couldn't speak English, and he's trying to tell him, you know, choo-choo train, 10 o'clock, Winnipeg, 10:10. Out, please, open door, no? In German mostly, and the guy, he wouldn't listen, and sit down, take it easy, I'll get a translator. So, 15, 20 minutes later, a translator finally comes, and what's the problem? And Dad explains it again. And again, it was, well, it's too late now, the train left 10 minutes ago. You better stay in the dorm. So they put Dad in the men's side, where the men and the older boys were. Well, the next morning at breakfast, there was Dad standing in the corridor. And he told us the story. And they suggested he could go out the next day or the 2 days later with the next train. The trouble was, that was January the 10th. And one of the worst blizzards that Canada ever had all across, you know. And it hit Halifax bad and buried Halifax. and there were no trains coming in. So they waited 4 days and 5 days. In the meantime, immigration phoned up Winnipeg, and they said, well, there's high unemployment, and nobody's hiring out here, and he's a stranger, you know, where are we going to put him up? And tell him to stay there with the family and go out in the springtime. And that's how we got stuck in Halifax. However, our boxes, our crates of belongings, clothes and bedding and dishes, all ended up going out to Winnipeg because they were on the train. Then by March and April, we decided, we met some German people on the sidewalk, and they had found a couple of meat markets, got a job at one, and by springtime we decided, oh, we may as well just stay in Halifax. People were telling us that Winnipeg was 3,000 miles away, that it's minus 40, 50 in the winter out there. You're better off to stay in the Maritimes. So we just stayed in the Maritimes. We stayed in Halifax.
So no idea of actually how far away it was.
Well, people told us. Yeah, no. And then on the map we realized. But originally, like, because the railway ticket cost so much money, Dad thought it was for the whole family.
Mm.
And somehow there was a mistake made with the travel agency and Dad's communication, because he bought a family ticket for the boat with meals, birth and everything, and then a rail ticket from Halifax to Winnipeg. A rail ticket cost a lot of money, so Dad just figured it was a family ticket. Never realized it was one adult. So that's how we get stuck in Halifax.
Why did he go to Canada in the first place? Did he have like great dreams of making it rich, or what was the motivation?
Just a new start, because he lost everything and had nothing and couldn't go to Berlin. We weren't welcome in Fulda. Where else do you go in Germany? It's the same situation.
Because I was thinking about it the other day. He was actually quite old. He must have been about 40.
42?
Yeah. That's 40. I mean, that's quite an age to give everything up and restart your life. And
you know, he was born in 13 and we came in 52, so.
Yeah. Nearly 40.
40, yeah. Mom was 5 years younger. Well, it was just because we were refugees, had nothing, and we were displaced people. Where do you go? You know, and we weren't loved in Germany. Oh, there was a hatred against the refugees. And that's why everybody, 400,000 or 500,000 left right after the war.
Do you think he was happy in Canada?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think in the end,
yeah,
like if he had to do it all over again, would he still have come to Canada?
Well, it was a culture shock, because in Canada things weren't as developed as what it was in Europe. Everything was cheap and was relatively easy. The people accepted us very well. There was never any hatred or animosity. The freedom, the openness, the clean air. I remember Mom and Dad talking about that lots of times. And
I suppose I grew up in industrial coal cities. And
yeah, that's right. Exactly. And the openness and the freedom, the friendliness of the people, and you know, you can buy a house anywhere you want to do, or you can build the way you liked it. No municipal regulations hardly, and if you wanted to build an addition to your house, you could. You know, if you want to paint it green, you did. Who cared? You know, in Europe, if you don't do it exactly like your neighbors, they complain. You know, so the take it easy attitude, you know. A relaxed attitude.
I know one story I wanted to get you to tell was one I always remember about the first time you ate corn on the cob.
Oh, well, it wasn't corn on the cob, it was just corn on the plate. This was in the immigration. One of the suppers, you know, every day there's different vegetables on the plate. Sometimes peas, and sometimes carrots, and sometimes it was corn. Oh, well, most of the Germans weren't going to eat corn. So it was chicken feed. No, I don't eat that stuff. And my mother, she said, well, if they put it on the plate, let's try a little bit. No, it's chicken food. Don't eat that stuff. And she tried it. She said, oh, it tastes pretty nice. It's nice and sweet. So that was in the immigration on the plate, the yellow corn. Well, and of course, in the summertime, we'd go to some beach somewhere at Williams Lake or, you know, Northwest Arm or someplace. And of course, in the fall of the year, somebody was eating corn on the cob, rolling it in the butter and salt and pepper on it, and we'd sit there and we'd look over at the other people at the other picnic table, and they'd say, do you want one? You know, and I'd say, well, yeah. Mom would say, I'll try it. I never ate it before. It looked so funny, nibbling it away off the corn cob and getting the butter all over your lips and mouth and chin. So Mom tried it, and it was good. And she'd ask Dad to try it. No, it's chicken food. I don't want that. Well, it took a month or so, and then Dad did try it, and then he likes it. But it was a similar situation. We'd go certain times of the year in the beaches, you'd see people boil a lobster. They'd eat that stinky lobster, and they'd work at getting the shells off of it. Then they'd eat the lobster, and we'd look over there, and we'd turn our noses up at them eating this ugly-looking thing, and struggling to get the shells off, you know, and sucking these little fingers to get the juice out and meat out. And we'd shake our heads and shake our heads, and then somebody would say, maybe one of the Canadians would say, would you like to try a piece? And Mom says, well, I'll try a little piece. And Mom liked it. I liked it. Daddy, the first three or four times that we were offered to us, he wouldn't. But then I remember a few years later, he loved it. But it's a similar situation. Canadians don't eat eels. But in Europe, everybody, in Holland and Germany, everybody eats eels. Smoked eels. You know, they're delicacy. They're, you know, the larger the better. And in Canada, nobody eats eels. Well, in Germany, it was the vice versa. We eat the eels, but not these silly-looking dinosaur lobsters.